You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So if you're watching the show, you'll see I'm not sitting in front of my usual backdrop. I'm not in front of my stately presidential library. So there's some work being done downstairs in my house. We had a bathroom door that's been broken for a long time. Finally taking care of it before the holidays. So I've retreated to, it's not quite a panic room, but, sort of like a bunker. But I'm sad because I was going to show off. I finished Andrew Johnson in my presidential reading series.
Wow.
So I'm up to Grant.
There's a big Grant book that everyone loves.
Well,
I have,
before I get to Grant, I do want to plug High Crimes and Misdemeanors by Gene Smith because it was a really, really well-written book. And I don't know if people have historical quibbles with it. I haven't delved into the broader scholarship of Andrew Johnson. It's an older book, and a lot of times older books I find are hard to read. The style is kind of stale and stodgy, and so it's not fun. This was a good read. This was like a good, gripping, dramatic read. It had a little bit about Andrew Johnson's life story, but it's mostly about the impeachment itself. And there's just a ton of drama in the impeachment trial. It gets kind of talked about in kind of like a, you know, two sentence shrug off. You know, Lincoln was killed, and Andrew Johnson came in. He was a racist.
We never hear any of the details.
The details are amazing. And people who have gotten more aware of Thaddeus Stevens after the Lincoln movie, the Spielberg movie about Lincoln.
Tommy Lee Jones
right.
plays.
So you can sort of imagine, like, Tommy Lee Jones, if they did a sequel, and you see Thaddeus Stevens in the Johnson impeachment saga. Not that he was a main player, but he was a significant player. Charles Sumner, who got, you know, savagely beaten before the Civil War, he's a major figure as well.
Total loser.
And you have, like, I mean, we talk about constitutional crises. Like, this was a genuine constitutional crisis. You literally have the president saying the Secretary of War is dismissed and being replaced by so-and-so, and the guy goes to the Secretary of the War office, and the former secretary doesn't leave, and they're literally face-to-face. I'm the Secretary of War. No, I'm the Secretary of War. I mean, that's a constitutional crisis.
Yes.
And so
it's like that, what's the Batman meme where there are two Batmen pointing at each other? Similar thing, yes.
So it's just a really, really well-written book. Maybe All people right. have other criticisms about it, but as far as an enjoyable read, it's a good read. So
here's what I'm thinking, though, Bill. You've seen Julie and Julia, or Julian, whatever that is.
The Julia Child movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's about this blogger and, yeah.
I have seen the movie. I did not read the blog.
I think... I hope you're keeping notes in a journal as you read these, because this, you could turn this maybe into a memoir of reading a presidential biography.
Well, as you know, my spirit animal, the guy who does the best presidential bios blog, I feel like...
Is this the pilot?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I feel like he's done this so much better than I could do, because he reads like six of every one, you know? He doesn't just go one and moves on to the next one. He does a whole canon for each president and then reviews each individual one and does a group review. I mean, I can't...
But does
I can't
he have a powerful
that.
Platform at Politico Magazine and Blogging Heads TV?
Well, you know, I already did my Politico article about the best presidential mistress memoirs. So
yeah.
I pulled that one off. I don't know if
you only had to stay up 48 hours straight to do it.
But on Grant, I was given the Chernow Grant book, which got a lot of attention, a lot of accolades, I think last year. But before I got that book, I bought Ronald White's Grant biography, which came out, I think, the year prior. And he's a professional historian. You know, Chernow is a popular historian, not a PhD historian. And I read White's Lincoln biography, which is very good. So I kind of feel like, you know, poor Ronald White's not getting his due here.
Yeah.
I should read his book, not Chernow's book. So I'm at least starting with White's.
I always wonder about that, right? So anyone could, if you write about history, study history, you could say you're an historian, but you got to have the PhD to be like, how do you become, it's like an economist or something. Like, can you just hang up a shingle? How do you get credentialed for this?
I don't believe Cherno is a credentialed historian, but you sell enough history books, you get called an historian. So
yeah. And there are people who write great histories who may not have the academic background.
Right.
But they're adhering to, you know, to proper standards.
One of the fans of this show who have had some interesting, you know, offline conversations with, explained to me that accredited historians, academic historians, often can't get contracts to write so-called cradle-to-grave biographies. They're not asked to do that. They're asked to do more niche type of work where you really do more original research. You know, yeah. A cradle to grave often doesn't involve a lot of original research. It's usually a synthesis of what other people have done. Maybe, right. I think Chernow does some shoe leather stuff. Like I know with the Hamilton book, he went down to the Caribbean island where Hamilton was and, you know, went through some of the old, ledgers there. But by and large, he's not, it's not start to finish his original work. He's putting together other things. The books we generally read that sell very well are not done by a credentialed historians, or done by popular historians.
Yeah. By the way, have we talked about this? There's a great Robert Caro book. I listened to the book on tape, and I think it's called On Power or something, but it's basically a memoir of his life as a biographer. Hmm. And he literally had, in order to write that first book, The Path to Power, about Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. he couldn't get anybody to really, they were just, people in the Hill Country were just sort of telling him cliches or what they had told everybody else. So he moved there and lived there for years before he could get them to actually open up. But there's a lot of other cool stuff about how he pieced together all this stuff Robert Moses was doing in New York, and how this guy who had this pretty modest title and not that much like real statutory authority was able to basically run the city and all the infrastructure. I think you'd really like it. Maybe when you get done all the presidents, yeah. You will have time to check that out.
All right. We should get cracking though.
This is the content. And by the way, I'm hoping they don't ever try to credential political commentators. We do not need that, certainly.
Perhaps your average political science professor would disagree with you.
Well, that's why they're not writing too dumb to fail, isn't it?
So you had a piece in the Daily Beast where you said all the Insta commentary on the Trump, Chuck, and Nancy brouhaha yesterday, all the takes that Trump was embarrassed, that Nancy ate him for lunch, you think that's all wrong, and Trump won the day.
Yeah, I definitely think he won the day. The question is, does he win? Like, that's the battle. The day is the battle. Does he win the war, right? But I definitely think he won the day. I thought Chuck Schumer looked very uncomfortable. I thought Donald Trump looked to be in command and in control. I know there's a conventional wisdom that says that they baited Trump into admitting he wanted a shutdown. They set a trap and he fell for it. I think that Trump looked like he was the one encouraging transparency. He wanted the cameras there. Whether that makes for good negotiating or not, I think it's good politics. And I think that Trump demonstrated to his base that he is fighting for something that they care deeply about, which is the wall. That matters a lot to them. And if you think about it, what does Trump have to lose? So normally Republican politicians normally have always lost shutdown battles. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But part of the reason that they might cave would be that they were afraid of public opinion. You know, who needs a shutdown at Christmas time? There's going to be bad media stories about it. And they were worried about losing re-election. I don't think Trump, especially considering that we've got 2 years until the next election, but also considering the fact that he's no normal politician, I don't think he's as susceptible to those incentives. And the last point I'll make is, I also don't think he is committed or wedded to anything he said yesterday. I think he is a shapeshifter and very well could tomorrow blame Democrats for, you know, he said, I'll take the heat, blame me. You know, if they won't take a deal on DACA, he's going to blame them and it might work. So anyway, I had an unconventional contrarian take on this one.
Well, I agree with a number of your particulars. I disagree with your overall conclusion. I agree that this plays well to Trump's base. And I agree that Trump is not susceptible to traditional political pressures because he's not a traditional politician or president. But I do go back to my point from a year ago, which was shutdowns are for losers, which I wrote for Politico. This is when Democrats were instigating the shutdown over DACA. And a lot of people said, you know, every time there's a shutdown, Republicans get blamed because everyone knows they hate government. So Democrats can force the issue free from the knowledge that they won't get blamed for. And I said, no, that's wrong. That's the wrong takeaway from the Ted Cruz Obamacare shutdown and the Newt Gingrich Medicare Medicaid shutdown. The lesson is, if you instigate the shutdown, you get the blame. Yeah, no matter where you stand on the issue in isolation that you're trying to draw attention to, by conflating it with keeping the government open, you seem like the crybaby. You're being petulant. You're inconveniencing others to make a crass political point that no one thinks is the way, or very few people think is the way, one should go about doing the business of government. And so in the case of Gingrich, in the case of Cruz, after the drubbing happened at the polls, they eventually caved and did not get what they wanted.
In the case of Cruz, remember, Republicans shut down the government in September or October of 2014. They went on to lose.
2013.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. 2013. They went on to lose the 2013 gubernatorial election in Virginia.
Right.
And I think they may be to blame for that. But a year later, they did quite well in the midterms. So,
people who made their argument forget in the intervening time, they didn't have any more shutdowns.
Right.
When they came up to September 2014, they said, let's not do this again before the midterm election.
No, I completely agree with that theory, but we are now 2 years out from the next election.
Well, I can't predict about 2020 from this. But yeah. I think I can very confidently say...
But what difference does it make if they get blamed? What's the consequence?
The consequence is, do you get what you want out of this negotiation? If you're... Newt Gingrich did not get to cut Medicare and Medicaid by employing a shutdown tactic. Ted Cruz did not get to defund Obamacare because of the shutdown tactic. Now, in the Democratic shutdown of 2018, January, February 2018... it's a bit more complicated, but because it wasn't protracted. You had folks on the left agitating for a shutdown to insert a DACA protection in whatever bill is passed to keep the government open. And I suspect that Schumer and others never really had their hearts in that, but they felt kind of forced into it. So Schumer does... instigate a shutdown while at the same time offering a deal for wall funding in exchange for DACA, which Trump rejects.
Right.
And then it's Joe Manchin and some of the more moderate Democrats that break away and say, this shutdown is bullshit. We're not letting this go on for much longer. And they basically, it's over by the end of the weekend, if I remember correctly.
What if Trump offers DACA this time?
Well, my point a year ago was, hey, Democrats, DACA's not in trouble right now. The courts are keeping it alive. You don't have any incentive to capitulate on the wall. Status quo is good for you. Hold fast, and Republicans will cave, which is eventually what happens. They don't give Trump his wall money in the bill to keep the government open. So now it's, and at that point, there are people on the left who didn't believe the courts were really going to stick to that. There was a temporary restraining order stopping Trump's order, and people thought, oh, the judges are all conservative now. They're not going to stick to that. Well, they have. DACA is still alive, and it's a year later, and they're reissuing two-year permits. If you're eligible and you have to reapply, you get it for 2 years, and that's going to take it beyond 2020 for a good number of people, which is why, no matter what happens at the court level between now and the election, Democrats can say, you know what, 2020 is looking pretty good for us. Let's just hold out until then, see how that election goes, and maybe we don't have to do any kind of concessions at all. So you're not seeing much in the way of concessions from Schumer and Pelosi right now. But you have Trump saying, and Trump this whole time seems to be itching for a shutdown. I mean, he seems to have wanted before and never got it on his terms previously. Which is why Schumer, I think, is sort of factually wrong from that exchange yesterday. Schumer was like, oh, you know, Trump said, this was your shutdown last time. And Schumer was like, oh, no, you said 20 times. Trump's actually right about that exchange. Yes, Trump did say several times he wanted a shutdown, but the actual shutdown was instigated by Democrats at that time. This one, Trump seems to really want it. I mean, there's no one else calling for it but him. You're not seeing McConnell call for it. You're not seeing Paul Ryan call for it. You're not seeing anybody in the... Well, maybe Lindsey Graham is egging Trump on now because he's always doing his, you know, shuffle in South Carolina. But for the most part, this is driven by Trump. You are correct that it plays to his base, but his base is not the majority. And there was a poll that came out that said two out of every three Republicans want Trump to hold out and shut down the government if he can't get his wall funding. Well, that's not three out of three. That's two out of three. There's a chunk of the Republican Party that doesn't want to do that. So it's not the entirety of the Trump vote, the 46% that he got in 2016. It's going to be less than that. Maybe it's 30 to 35% that wants that. So if you were a rational Republican, you would say, that's not a very good leg to stand on. I'm not going to win in the court of public opinion once this happens. There's no incentive for Democrats to climb down if I'm going to get knocked back below 40 over this. So where's the end game here? Now, Trump may say, I don't care that there's no end game here. This makes my hardcore base happy. Maybe this goes on for 3 months. Who cares? Maybe this does kill my election prospect in 2020. Who cares? This is a fun fight, and I like having this fight. So I think there is a good chance here that Trump is going to provoke this and feel like it is good for him, and therefore will have zero incentive to climb down, even when the polls show that he's losing the larger argument.
Look, so I would say a couple things. One, there's, of course, a decent possibility that Trump is going to back down. He's going to change his mind. They'll give him some small win on something, or he'll be able to claim victory on something and keep the government running. But now he has had this moment where he has, like, publicly signaled to his base and stood up to Chuck and Nancy rhetorically, and that's worth something for the base. That's one possibility. The other option is, I think, what you think, it sounds like you think is more likely, which is that he really wants a shutdown and he doesn't have any incentive, like he's impervious to public opinion and to election concerns. I would argue not only because he's weird, but also because it's 2 years out. And so think of it this way. Who is the most vulnerable to a shutdown? Because you know Donald Trump's not just going to sit there and actually take the blame no matter what he said yesterday. He's going to be saying, I offered them DACA. They didn't do it. These people, they're the problem. They're the politicians. I would argue that a normal politician like Chuck and Nancy, who are real politicians, are more likely to – you know, in a game of chicken, to relent than Donald Trump is.
But why, so that gets why would you relent over DACA when you can do nothing and DACA is on the books?
Well, it's not these folks are not permanently saved.
It's not codified. I mean, you would bake in some more long-term guarantee, but you can play for time and feel pretty good that you're going to have a good election in 2020, and you could then do immigration reform on your own terms.
I think it's possible that this is totally unfair. I think it's possible that the public could start to turn on Chuck and Nancy by basically saying, look, this guy's we're dealing with a petulant child. Just you're the ones who are saying, give him what he wants. Just whatever. Who cares?
What do you think happens to the Democratic base if Pelosi and Schumer say, okay, give the baby his bottle, here's your wall? How do you think the progressive base of the Democratic Party responds to that?
Well, that's why they can't do what I think they should do. We've talked about this. I don't think the wall's that big of a deal. I would do the DACA for wall deal. And Trump's base really wants this. This was a signature promise from Donald Trump to his supporters that he was going to do it.
No, the promise was that Mexico would pay for it. That was literally in his announcement speech. And this bill is not that. This proposal is not that.
Bill, you and I both know that they're going to pay for it one way or the other. And because of what you just said, the wall just got taller.
So I think you're misreading the pressure that will be put on Democrats. All the pressure on Democrats would be to, don't blink. You have zero incentive to blink. He is doing something fundamentally racist. His poll numbers are bad. Your poll numbers are good. And if you capitulate on this, you have confirmed every weak stereotype of Democratic leadership that the populist left has of you.
I think you've just talked me into the fact that this thing could get really ugly.
Yeah.
Because we always hand ring the shutdown, and then the adults come and pass a CR or something, right? And because we don't want to actually go through this. Look, I think if there was an election in March, everything you're saying would be true. Donald Trump just lost the House. He can't lose it again. We're 2 years out. Donald Trump wants to show that he is tough. He wants to set the agenda. And I am not convinced that I have this sense that you believe that Chuck and Nancy are clearly occupying the moral high ground, and that Trump is going to be cast, like Republicans almost always are, that Trump is going to be cast. And by virtue of yesterday saying, go ahead and blame me, they've got the video, that it's going to be easy. It's going to be a clear-cut case where Trump is obviously to blame for this. I'm just not convinced of that. I think Trump is a wily, I don't want to say politician, but operator.
Well, again, my argument is, regardless of what the people say out of their own mouths, the instigator always gets blamed, always has been blamed. I mean, Ted Cruz tried to shift blame, didn't work. Newt Gingrich tried to shift blame, didn't work.
Ted Cruz is no Donald Trump. Neither is Newt Gingrich. These are politicians.
Newt Gingrich was a pretty bombastic character in his day, and clearly thought he had the whip hand after winning the midterm election, and got harshly proven otherwise.
I think there's something about the bully pulpit, though, too. Newt Gingrich was not the president of the United States.
I mean, you don't even have to try to explain that Trump is the instigator, because he has already announced that he is the instigator.
That's yesterday's story, Bill. What's he going to say tomorrow? What's going to be tweeted tomorrow?
I'm sure he'll say five different things in the matter of an hour, but it's not a hard argument that this is driven by Trump. There's no national imperative for this wall. This is why.
A lot of people think there is, Bill.
Of course, in the hardcore Trump base, sure. But that's not the majority.
I think not just. I think this is more pervasive than that.
Oh, I would say the opposite. I would say the entirety of the Trump base is not diehard about the wall. It's a large, it's a majority faction, but it's not 100%. Every poll we've seen about the subject, the wall polls terribly.
I don't believe the polls. And I'll tell you, I think I probably butchered this on CNN this morning, but I can tell you, like, every time we would have these Republican primaries, like in 2016, and you would look at the exit polls, mm-hmm. people would say, I don't care that much about immigration. I'm okay with the pathway to citizenship. Immigration is my fifth most important issue. And guess what issue Donald Trump rode to the White House?
I agree with you on that, and I agree the mere fact that Trump emphasized it so much is more telling than any poll. I'm not disagreeing that the lion's share of his base wants this very much, but I do think there is a soft Trump faction that dips their toe in and out of being approving of Trump.
Yeah,
and it's this kind of episode that makes that faction scurry.
So I would just end my part by saying, you may end up being right. However, I think the difference between our takes is that you are operating in the rational world of the way things would work for any other politician. And my point is that I do think that the rules quite often do not apply to Trump. And I'm not saying it's magic necessarily, but some of it is that he tries, it's hard to fight an unorthodox fighter. You don't know what they're going to do. There's the whole madman theory. It's to game out and Chuck and Nancy, just like the 16 Republicans Donald Trump beat in the Republican primary, just like Hillary Clinton, are politicians who were brought up and trained to respond to rational actors. Well, and he is not a rational actor.
Well, I agree he's not a rational actor. Where I disagree is I think the rules do apply, even though he doesn't care about the rules. I don't think that he doesn't care about the rules doesn't mean the rules don't apply. And so the rules might be applying, and he's choosing not to care that they're applying, and therefore this goes on for a very long time.
I don't want to get meta on you, but not caring about the rules that do apply eventually could make the rules not apply.
Well, there's another way that this actually ends, which is this goes on for months. The polls are truly terrible.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell is not a fan of shutdowns. I mean, the reason why Trump hasn't gotten a shutdown to date, arguably, is that Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, said, look, guy, you can't do this. We have a midterm coming up. We're going to get killed if you do this. In fact, even in this September, they did kind of a three-car Monty is the quite word, but they gave him a defense spending bill tied to a two-month extension for some of the other appropriations bills that hadn't been agreed upon yet, and said, Trump, you can't veto spending for our military, and he signed it without a fuss. So they've done things to make it hard for him to do the shutdown. Now it's going to be a Democratic majority in the House, so you have that pressure, plus McConnell is not going to bend over backwards to have a prolonged shutdown. So if they're getting killed, if Republicans are getting killed, I mean, this is hard to imagine, and I don't think McConnell would enjoy it, but he might have to be like, look, we're putting this on the floor, and if we have to override your veto, Donald Trump, we're going to do that because this is insane.
It could happen. It's a crazy world. It could happen. I would also say, just to buttress my argument, that if Donald Trump is really worried about the Mueller investigation and about the possibility of impeachment, this distracts from that, and it secures his status with the base, which he would need. You know, forget about re-election. Surviving impeachment is about base, and this could conceivably be part of that.
I agree fully.
All right, so we're in agreement. What else do you want to talk about, Bill Scherer?
Well, you know, so there was this this article from Ezra Klein in Vox.
Yes.
About Paul Ryan's legacy. And when Ezra was at the Washington Post, it was kind of coming up as, you know, young blogger star. He jumped from the American Prospect blog to the Washington Post. So he was already seen as a liberal opinion journalist. He wasn't just a Washington Post reporter. He was one of the early folks to, took Paul Ryan's, proposed budgets, which are kind of conservative fantasy budgets, took him very seriously as, here's a guy who, while I don't agree with the end goal of this budget, is seriously trying to put a budget together with, numbers that work and being candid about the trade-offs that he's making and, speaking in unvarnished language. He talks about healthcare rationing, actually used the word rationing. So this is not some kind of, you know, a rosy proposal Ryan's doing. We should engage him as a serious thinker and debate his policies on the merits. And this is going back to 2010 when he, they weren't even the majority yet. He was the ranking member on the budget committee. And Paul Krugman at the time was like, this budget's insane. These numbers don't make any sense. There's no way they're going to create budget balance, save for total decimation of the federal government as we know it. And stop treating this guy like he's any kind of serious thinker at all. This is a total con job.
By the way, let me just say, I also at that exact time wrote a piece criticizing him. I wrote a piece at the Daily Beast, which was very controversial. And I got a lot of pushback from people at Heritage and elsewhere criticizing Paul Ryan from the right for voting on liberal stuff. So I was also more skeptical than Ezra at that time.
So for a while, Krugman was kind of the lonely voice. Most of the media treated his budgets like serious policy proposals. And it's only in these later months where his actual legislative legacy is the tax cut bill, which does nothing to solve a deficit problem, if you believe there is a deficit problem, which Paul Ryan says he did.
Well, not only that he did, but that we have to tackle it before it tackles us, right. And it's generational transformation of generational wealth. Right. And I mean, he was like apocalyptic.
Right, about we're going to be Greece.
Debt and deficits stuff. You know, right. Stuff. So yeah.
So Ezra has this sort of, you know, political obituary for Paul Ryan, where he says, you know, I was wrong. You know, I should have saw through this in the first place.
It's like the piece I wrote about Palin a few years ago.
Yeah.
The I was wrong piece really can pop.
Yeah, no, that definitely got a lot
underrated.
Of attention. But I want to ask you this, Matt. And look, I wrote at the time that Paul Ryan's numbers didn't make any sense. So it's not like I was in Ezra's camp at the time. But I do think it's a little pat to say Paul Ryan is strictly a con artist. He didn't have to say my proposal involves rationing of healthcare. I mean, that's not a poll tested phrase.
If he probably wouldn't use it.
And so the notion that he did that solely to impress the, you know, Washington establishment centrist punditocracy and make himself look like a serious person in their eyes, that doesn't quite gel with me. At the same time, I think his numbers never made any sense. I don't think he was being fully candid about what his budget really entailed. So I personally have a bit of sympathy for Ezra at the time, saying, hey, this guy's doing something a little bit different here. He couldn't have known 8 years later what he would actually end up passing. And even today, I have a hard time squaring those two elements, that he was trying to talk about tough medicine while at the same time putting a heavy gloss on what he was actually proposing. So as someone, Matt Lewis, who is not, who, you know, you're Mr. Too Dumb to Fail, take you.
Is that
you
a compliment?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know,
it's not a memoir. It's not an autobiography.
you're not happy with how Paul Ryan came out of this, but can you give us any insight into what makes a guy like Paul Ryan tick? Do you think Paul Ryan was just a con? Or do you think there is something that there's some sort of internal struggle that the serious conservative deals with and has a hard time squaring the dual objectives of shrinking government and cutting taxes and balancing the budget, triple objectives, if you will?
Yeah, look, I mean, I have probably a nuanced take on him. I'll just tell you. I find Paul Ryan fascinating, and I'll just give you my perspective on him. So the first thing to know about him is he was an incredibly ambitious staffer who basically kissed people's ass in order to, like, let them be his mentor. So he was kind of the protege. They were the mentor. And I think if he found a better mentor, he would hop to that better mentor. He came of age during a time when the sort of Jack Kemp, Bill Bennett stuff was popular. And I think that helps explain. I mean, you compare Jack Kemp to Donald Trump. That will tell you the story of the tension between Paul Ryan, Jack Kemp, who believed in, you know, compassionate conservatism and free markets and human flourishing and the right to rise and all the stuff that Jeb Bush lost on, essentially. That is how Ryan cut his teeth in terms of public policy. And he ends up with Donald Trump. And trying to survive in that milieu, and I think that tells you a lot of the story. I think that he, even though he was very ambitious, I believe that there's a good side of him, and that overall he wanted to do a good job for America. I think he had competing interests. I think he believes that tax cuts can stimulate the economy. I think he also believes that debt and deficits are dangerous and could lead to some very bad things down the road. I think his solution, and this is very simplistic, was to do entitlement reform, because as you know, aside from defense spending, entitlements account for the largest, you know, sort of share of our spending. But I think he's also, this is where I think it goes off the rails. Instead of becoming a sort of a gadfly cult hero who completely sticks to his principles, kind of a kinder, gentler Ron Paul, let's say, Paul Ryan decides I can do more good and implement my agenda from the inside, right? So that means he has to play the game, right? So that means he actually wants to be on I think it was the Appropriations Committee or the Tax Committee. Some, you know, he wanted to be essentially a budget wonk, and ends up becoming Speaker, where now he gets a president thrust upon him who doesn't want to do entitlement reform, doesn't care about deficits or debt. So what could Paul Ryan do? Well, he still believes in taxes and that taxes can stimulate the economy. That's the only tool in his toolbox left to use, so he does it. So I think what you have is a complicated story. And it's a little bit sad because I think there's a version of this story where Paul Ryan does become a transformational, you know, heroic figure, but that is not how it played out for him.
Is it possible that Ryan just isn't as smart as he thinks he is and as smart as a lot of Washington folks thought he was, that he just got in over his head as far as what one has to do to put together a sensible budget, and so ends up putting aside what he actually got into law with the tax cut, the budget proposals themselves involved a lot of cutting corners, glossing over, magic asterisks and things like that. Is it possible he is never really could confront what actually was involved in what he was proposing?
So you have to understand you're talking to somebody, obviously, who has a conservative bias in favor of Paul Ryan's political worldview or ideological worldview. And I'm not like best friends with him, but I've spent a little time with him. And I'm under the impression that he is highly intelligent. And I believe that his bigger failing is not that the numbers didn't add up, or I don't think his failing had to do with policy, or I think his failing was as a politician. I think that it was he was never cut out to be Speaker of the House. I think that he ended up Donald Trump, you know, was just big-footed everybody. But at the end of the day, I think that the big sin of Paul Ryan wasn't a failure to understand budgets, or it wasn't that he was incorrect about public policy. I mean, look, I think if we actually had if we had been able to implement a lot of the things that Paul Ryan wanted to do, including entitlement reform, when he wanted to do them, I believe America would be in a lot better shape today, but it wasn't going to happen. Now, who understood it? Donald Trump understood the politics of it. So I would argue that Ryan was naive and outmaneuvered politically. I'm not saying he's perfect, but I still think that by and large, Ryan's ideas were pretty sound. That's my take.
I'll give you the last word on that. but I know you have to run. So anything you want to plug before we wrap up?
I just interviewed John Podhoretz for the Matt Lewis and the News podcast. And so we did a podcast on my sort of iTunes Stitcher, my main podcast, where we discussed, you know, we talked politics, we talked Nick Ayers, and we talked about, I think we talked Chuck and Nancy a little bit, and we talked about these progressive scolds who are trying to get rid of Baby It's Cold Outside and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. You know the type, Bill.
Yeah.
and we talked about that. But then, as a bonus for Patreon contributors, we went over to my Patreon page, /Matt Lewis, and I noticed that the last five movies that J-Pod reviewed for the Weekly Standard, I've seen them. So we actually did some, you know, we talked about Bohemian Rhapsody, and we talked about A Star Is Born, and had a good time engaging in some non-political commentary.
Excellent. Well, I think I mentioned on the last show, but my podcast with author Patricia O'Toole, who wrote the Woodrow Wilson biography, The Moralist, that is up at the New Books and Politics podcast feed also at newbooksnetwork.com. And I should have one more coming soon, but I can plug that next week.
Very good. All right. And so just for those out there who are, you know, anxiously awaiting the next DMZ episode, Bill and I are dealing with some stuff. But we're hoping, I think the plan is to get one more in before Christmas, right?
Yes, one more before Christmas, and our year-end spectacular.
So will that be the year-end episode then? That's the last one before the new year.
I, I, I think in all likelihood the next show is going to be the last one of the year.
Okay. So just, you know, stay tuned to the at DMZ show Twitter feed and check your local listings. But Bill and I are going to try hard to get in one more DMZ before the new year.
And we can talk about all we got right and wrong this year.
Well, I'm going to have to give some deep thought to that because, as you know, it's mostly just home runs. Occasionally.
This is my year of getting things right, so I need to talk about that.
That's right. You did have a pretty good year of predictions.
Thank you.
So, all right, Bill, Cher, everybody. We'll see you hopefully back here in the DMZ next week.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.